Composer Eric Whitaker and poet and lyricist Charles Anthony Silvestri, who goes by Tony with his friends, first met in college choir at the University of Nevada. Eric was an undergrad, and Tony was working on his doctoral thesis. Because of that chance encounter, they not only became lifelong best friends, but professional collaborators, and their latest project is called The Sacred Veil. It's the journey of a soul crossing the threshold into the next world. But this is a very personal journey, as you'll find out on this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Elmacher. I'm talking with Eric Whitaker and Charles Anthony Silvestri about a new recording, a new project called The Sacred Veil. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're thrilled to be here.
Can we start off, Eric and Tony, just by talking a little bit about your friendship and how long you've been friends and collaborators?
Yeah, I'll take this one to start, Tony. This is Eric. By the way, Charles Anthony Silvestri is his formal name. All of his close friends call him Tony. Tony and I met in college choir at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I was in the third year of my seven-year undergraduate degree, and Tony was taking a break from graduate school, writing his doctoral thesis. That's right, isn't it, Tony?
That's right.
You'd come back to take a year off, and you grew up in Vegas.
I needed to study for my qualifying exams and then get a head start on my dissertation. And you can't not be in a choir, so I approached the university and joined a choir, and you happened to be in it.
That's it. And we've talked about this a couple of times, and we can't remember never being best friends. I don't remember even our first meeting. I just remember there was the time before Tony in my life and then the time afterwards. And so we sang just for that year together, right, Tone? Then you went back
That's right. Yeah, I went back to L.A.
That's it. And so then we kept in touch over the years. And then I moved to Los Angeles 10 years later, I think, or 9 years later. Tony was living in Los Angeles then teaching. And this was right about the time that I wrote a piece called Lux Aurumque. And I had a little English poem by the poet Edward Esch, and I asked Tony if he would translate it into Latin for me.
And my specialty as a historian is Roman and medieval history, and so I had studied Latin. And my wife, Julie, also was a Latin teacher in high school. And so Eric asked me to translate this poem into Latin. And as a choir member also, I was thinking, all right, there are lots of different ways of rendering this poem in Latin, and which would be the most singable? And so I would chant through various translations that I would make and, you know, make choices for which words work better. And Eric said, oh, I love the sound I want as many ums as possible. And I tried to explain that, you know, you can't just make every word end with so I had to make some choices to make it not only defensible to a classicist as an appropriate translation, but also as singable as possible and with as many ums as possible. That was our first collaboration.
Yeah, that's how we met.
Yeah, I really can't say when we became best friends. We just were brothers from the very first time we saw each other.
I would imagine that it was that sense of closeness and trust that allowed you, Tony, to be able to set a poem on Eric's piano 3 years ago that became the seed for this newest project that you're working on.
Yeah, this is a poem that I wrote. My wife died in 2005, and I had a long time to think and to grieve and not to grieve, as we'll talk about. But this first movement of the piece represents a kind of 35,000-foot view of everything that I've learned about this grief process and about life and death and eternity, and it's in that poem that this idea of the sacred veil between this world and eternity first sort of took shape. And I was in Los Angeles for a funeral of a beloved aunt of mine, my Aunt Joan. And I left the copy of the poem on Eric's piano while I went to the funeral. And I was going to read this poem as well at her funeral. And then by the time I got back, Eric had already begun to explore the possibilities of that poem. And you're right to speak of trust. You know, I hadn't shared that poem widely at all. It was a very personal thing to me. And I really wanted to know what Eric thought of it. And I wanted to know how he might respond to it.
Do you by chance have that poem in front of you where you could read it for us?
I do. Whenever there is birth or death, the sacred veil between the worlds grows thin and opens slightly up, just long enough for love to slip silent, either in or out of this our fragile, fleeting world, whence or whither a new home waits. And our beloved ones draw near, in rapt anticipation or in weary gratitude they stand. Our loved ones stand so close, right here, just on the other side of eternity. And I was fascinated by this idea of Julie not being far away from me, but being right here with me, that this veil that separates this world from the next is always around us. Now, it's in powerful places like cathedrals and shrines and emergency rooms and places where births and deaths occur. Those are numinous places. They're powerful places. But our loved ones are also very near us, and they stand here just they're closer than we think.
Eric, when you first saw that poem, what was the first thing that came to your mind?
Well, I immediately knew what Tony was writing about. So exactly as Tony said, this is it's his bird's eye view of everything he's learned and everything he's gone through. And then I just fell into the words. For me, when I'm composing music, there's this extraordinary relationship, this dance that happens with the poem. And I always try to choose the very best poems, the ones that are pregnant with music. They're just bubbling with music. And this was exactly that. I remember it was at the piano and I sat down. Usually, by the way, my process is to memorize a poem and live with it for days or weeks or sometimes months before music starts to emerge. And here I just started reading it and started playing along. That rarely, rarely happens. It's the music was already there. And I could see the structure. The moment I read it, oh, there it is. There's the piece. Here's how it opens. Here's where the climax is. Here's how it ends. All of the music is built into the poetry itself, which is Tony's great talent as a poet, I think, is his ability to fill his words with musical possibility.
Eric lives in this kind of chord world for a long time, trying to find the golden nugget, you know. What do you call it? The golden brick.
Yeah.
That unlocks or that becomes the foundation stone of an edifice. And so he plays around on the piano trying to find that harmonic language, that chordal language. And that's a fascinating process for me to watch. And we've had 20 years together of collaborative work to watch that process. But with this particular piece, what I found happening was Eric was exploring sonic worlds unlike any of his other compositions. He was almost pushed into a totally new landscape, inventing a kind of new language to express these thoughts and these words of mine. And I wondered about that, and I wondered if it was in part Eric's grief process. I mean, Eric knew and loved Julie as well, and he had to grieve her as well through this process. I mean, I don't know. Is that an accurate vision of what was going through your head, Bud?
Yeah, I think so. It's incredibly emotional at the beginning and intuitive for me, right? So I'm not processing any of that while it's happening. I'm just aware that there's this music that is in the words and is finding its way to my fingers. What it often feels like to me is that we talked about this little golden brick, is that I'm able to reach across the veil, I guess, and take this little golden brick out, and then all of the DNA in the piece is there in just that little emotional idea. It's hard to talk about. But in this case, so even the opening lines, whenever there is birth or death, it's so dramatic. And there's a formality to it also. It's almost liturgical. And I remember sitting at the piano and thinking to myself, that's a complete thought. That's a complete idea. Whenever there is birth or death, I realized immediately that if I repeated it three times, whenever there is birth or death, whenever there is birth or death, whenever there is birth or death, it gives a liturgical formality to it. We're just going to meditate on this single idea. And it also stops forward momentum. Little island that sits completely on its own, and the mind sort of surrenders this need to move forward. And so instantly what I found was that the entire piece had this structure of threes built into it. And that's when I had my golden brick. That it rarely happens that immediately or that viscerally, but that was it. From there then, the whole piece had to be based on permutations of the number three.
Well, and I remember that moment too where you suggested that there were more movements of this work, that it wasn't just this one poem, that this poem would explode out, it would grow out like a seed into multiple movements, and we had long conversations about what this piece could be and could we even do it? Could we go to the place that we needed to go to in order to write this work?
Somehow embedded in this relatively short poem that you wrote was a much bigger work. And yeah, like you said, you and I really talked. Is this something we want to do? Do we really want to go digging in the dirt?
Yeah. As a poet, I hadn't written about Julie's death. I hadn't written about her cancer. I hadn't written about my grief. I hadn't written about the sadness, the anger, the frustration. I just had never explored it. And the only times I had ever tried to touch that place, the poems were intellectual. They were brainy poems rather than heart poems. And I think what I had to come to grips with when Eric and I decided to explore this idea in multiple movements was that I finally, as a poet, had to go to those dark places. I had to revisit the moment of Julie's death. I had to revisit the joy of our love together, and then the sadness and sorrow of her diagnosis, and the heartache about thinking about our kids, and the fact that Julie wanted to be a mom. All these emotions, these places that I didn't really want to go to again, I had to journey there again in order to create the texts that are in the Sacred Veil. And Eric was so tender and so generous and so... he was my brother, leading me through that process and encouraging me and giving me the time and the space that I needed to write what I needed to write. And it was a powerful catharsis for me to take this journey. And now seeing the whole piece with my words and Julie's words and Eric's words together to tell this wonderful story, this powerful story, it's really meaningful for me.
Tony, how difficult, or I guess Tony and Eric, how difficult was it for the two of you to bring this work, the psychological and the emotional journey, to life?
Well, I mean, there's a practical difficulty. Eric lived in Los Angeles and I lived in Kansas. And so there's physical distance between us, but there's not spiritual or emotional distance between us. I'd like to think that I know how Eric thinks, and I know how he'll respond, and I know the language that he speaks in, and vice versa. And so we trust each other to be able to go through this process. So that's the practical aspect of your question. Then there's the emotional aspect, and we really did need to support each other emotionally through this entire process.
Yeah, Tony, there was we had this one golden brick of an idea, this first piece, but we didn't even know this would be the first. We didn't know where it would sit. We didn't know what it could be. So we had long, long talks about what is the journey that we want to take? What do we want to explore? What is here? And for myself, I said, let's just start with the pillars of a story. And so the first thing I asked Tony to write about was the moment of Julie's death. Tony was there in the room with her. And so I asked him to write about that. And then I gave him very, very specific music that was taken directly from this first movement that we'd already written, saying it needs to be in this exact meter. Like, okay, let's just build this pillar and see what we've got. And that was the movement You Rise, I Fall, which is the second to the last, the penultimate movement.
I found that immensely comforting. I got to interrupt and say that giving me that little bit of musical material became a kind of crutch almost. It was a handrail that I could hold on to as I went to that deep place, and it allowed the poem to come out. I don't know that I would have been able to write about the moment of her death had I not had some sort of superstructure on which to hang that experience.
And then after that, the next thing I asked Tony to write about was the moment that he knew that he was in love. And that's the third movement, which is called Home. And you described this moment that, well, why don't you tell it, Tony, that you were there on your second date?
Yeah,
I think.
It was our second date, and we had taken a drive through this beautiful canyon road to the J. Paul Getty Museum in Malibu, which is a beautiful place and filled with classical artwork, up on a bluff overlooking the Pacific in Malibu. And then we had a picnic on the beach, and Julie had brought strawberries, and we had cheese, and we were just lying there on a blanket on the beach with the waves crashing around us, and we were talking and talking and talking for so long, and I felt so safe. I felt so comfortable. I felt like I was home, and she felt like home to me. It was an uncanny feeling. It really was. And, people say, I knew she was the one, or we'd love at first sight. I mean, having experienced that, it's true. That does happen. And we just, both of us just knew that we were safe with each other and that we were at home with each other.
And my recollection is that Tony, as part of telling this story, said that she was talking and he looked at her and had this single thought in his mind, which is, you feel like home. I remember you saying those words to me on the phone, Tony. And I wrote them down and said, that's it. That's it. That's all the poetry that we need for that entire movement. And now we had the moment of love and the moment of death. And those became really the pillars. All right, how do we build now this little cathedral around these very strong pillars?
In a dark and distant hill, a wanderer ancient and austere.
The very first thing that we hear after the opening, that first opening piece, whenever there's birth or death, is a complete shift in mood. In a dark and distant year. And I wanted to set the story in motion, in a way almost like a troubadour traveling through medieval Europe and singing for his supper. And I had written to Tony an email saying, do you still have the poem that I wrote you in the year that you turned 40? It was just the year,
it was a year after Julie
had died. Exactly. So sometimes for people's birthdays, I'll write poems for them. And I wrote Tony a poem for his 40th birthday. And neither one of us could find this poem. We tried to reconstruct in our minds. All I had was, I could remember the opening stanza that I had written in a dark and distant year when I was young and full of fear. I was called to fight a war that was not mine. I was a child then, and I was 39. And this poem sort of detailed this battle that Tony fought, but then realizing he only had a wooden sword against this army that was a greater force than he was prepared for or could even imagine, and that somehow had made it through the other side and had become a man. You remember all of this, Tony?
Mm-hmm. And I remember how hard that party was. I was really in a dark place, and to celebrate one's 40th, you know, milestone birthday in the midst of a dark place, the poem helped.
And so I said to Tony, I said, let's take that structure, and then I'd like you to write a poem describing yourself, but kind of in the third person, as if a troubadour were telling a story of this young man.
I loved the task because I could use sort of antiquated language. As a medievalist, I've read a lot of that literature, and I love Tolkien and sort of that genre of writing. And so I got a chance to kind of flex that a little bit in that particular poem. The hard part, though, was talking about myself. And I think I've given a pretty honest view of myself before I met Julie. And then also in this particular movement is when we first meet.
Tony always throws what I call softballs, and what I mean by that is he'll give a word or a phrase that is so loaded with music, it's a gift to a composer. There's just nothing else to do but do what the poem says to do. So in this case, Tony's opening line, in a dark and distant year, what is it? It's a wanderer, ancient,
ancient and austere.
And so then what I did is I saw that word wanderer, and for me, that's a softball. So then that entire movement in terms of keys just wanders. We change keys 3 or 4 times. Wanderer allowed me musically to just wander all over the place. And then its sister movement, which is movement number 9.
Yes.
That's the one that I ended up writing. I wrote the poetry because I knew Tony. I knew him so well that he could never write about himself in a heroic way. And I truly believed, watching Tony go through what he had gone through, that he was a hero. When someone is truly sick the way Julie was, the focus is on that person, as it should be. But the person who was standing at their side going through all of it is not seen as the hero that they are. That is an earth-shattering experience. And so I just knew that Tony wouldn't be able to write about himself in the way that I saw him. And so I wrote the poetry using this same structure. And in both cases, we quote different pieces that we'd written together. So for instance, the last line that I wrote is, "From the shore he sees his bride as she fights hard against the tide. He swears a sacred vow that every loved one keeps. He steals himself, takes one last breath, and leaps." I'm directly quoting Tony's words from Leonardo Dreams of His Flying Machine.
In a way, we each took that opportunity to kind of nod to one another and do honor to our friendship as well.
And some of the text actually comes from Julie herself. Would you talk a little bit about how you found some of these pieces? I'm thinking about the fourth movement, Magnetic Poetry, where that beautiful, I just love this line, "essential you, like some diamond gift incubating in love." Wow, that's pretty powerful to write like in a diary or a blog.
Yeah, and I don't remember how organically it came about, but we thought that maybe Julie's voice should be heard in this piece. And so I did something that I hadn't done since she died, which was read through her journals, her diaries. I read through her medical record. I read through all of her email blogs that she sent out while she was sick. And so in her journal, I found this, and she'd labeled it magnetic poetry. And I remember somebody had given us one of those poetry sets with the little magnet words, and you stick them on the fridge. And, you know, every time we'd go by, we would move words around and write little poems to each other. And unbeknownst to me, she had written some of these down that she had created on the fridge. And I saw this one, and I think I just sent a photograph of it to Eric.
Yeah, exactly.
Thinking, is this something that we can use? And it truly is just a mesmerizing poem.
To me, this is one of the great poems of the 20th century. It really is exquisite. Exquisite poetry, especially because what was going on in your life at the time.
Yeah, we had been married a few years, and Julie desperately wanted to be a mother, and we wanted a family so badly, and we were having such a hard time conceiving a child. And, you know, we would have our hearts broken month after month. And so she talks about egg ache and not yet a mother and am I a woman? The part I love is the delirious girl, and then the choir explodes with woman goddess. This is really how Julie felt about herself. She was so timid and so sweet, you know, but she also had this powerful mama bear energy to her, and this idea of woman goddess, earth mother, was part of her identity as well. And, you know, I would love to know what Julie would be like now in her 50s, how she would have embraced this, a different chapter in her life, as her period of fertility would be over and she would be coming into her power as a crone. That's the word she would have used to describe herself post-menopause. But, you know, we didn't get a chance to understand what Julie would be like then. But I think we get a little sense of what Julie would be like right now in that line, woman goddess. I think that's how she saw herself. Yes.
And she also was recalling the experience of being with the kids when they were small, in that Delicious Times reference, where I think your children, which were fairly young at the time, were kind of discovering that mom wears a wig, and that was kind of fun. And I mean, it's just so interesting to me how this becomes just so like every day. This is our everyday existence right now.
She felt very strongly that if she was going to go through cancer, this journey, that she was going to be a help to other women, especially young moms who were going through cancer as well. And she saw this email blog at first as a way of sharing her story, her adventure, humanizing it. People were suffering on her behalf, and she wanted to ease their suffering. She really was an extraordinary person. And so there are two entries in The Sacred Veil that are drawn from Julie's email blog, which eventually went out to thousands of people all around the world. First one is the one you're referring to here, Delicious Times, where she describes losing her hair and the kids' reaction to her losing her hair.
It's been a very funny week. The kids have been amazing. And we've had some great delicious times.
And then the second one is where she asks for prayer. Diagnosis or prognosis from the doctor, and she was desperately asking her prayer warriors, as she called them, to really fight hard on her behalf spiritually.
My doctor said this man I most likely had about 2 months to live.
I'm not a big fan of generalized works of art that speak generally about a thing. I want all the details. And so with our two characters, if you will, with Tony as the hero and Julie, I wanted to know them. And I think it's essential that we know them, see their love, see the birth of the child, all of that before the cancer is even introduced, in terms, just in a dramatic sense. And when Tony sent me this poem, Magnetic Poetry, I knew her. In fact, I would have to say I knew Julie in a way that I didn't get to know her when she was alive reading that. Hmm. And so I feel like by the time we get to Movement 6, I'm afraid, that we really know these two people. We've really invested in them. And I dare say we love both of them. We've fallen in love with them, and we only want the best for them. For me, that's why when I'm Afraid begins... As an audience, you really feel it, because now you're holding hands on the journey with the two of you as you move through life.
Well, and we've just gone through the sort of sumptuous, delicious, delirious Movement 5, the instrumental movement that for me is those first few years of our relationship when things were great. It's just that wonderful, joyful, quiet. Imagine a lazy Sunday afternoon in summer. It captures a quiet moment where we're not really doing anything, and I'm doing my thing and she's doing her thing, but we catch each other's eye and smile at one another. Kids are playing nearby. It's one of those delicious times, I guess, to use Julie's phrase. I'm Afraid comes in and gives a real sense of how cancer ruins all of that.
This work, The Sacred Veil, features choir and also piano and cello. How did you choose these two instruments, and what do they represent?
Such a good question. So, like I do with every piece that I write, I write a kind of a very woolly, diffuse version of it at first, and then I slowly start whittling away the edges to try to get to the most essential parts of the music. And so as I kept cutting away, then it became, oh, it's definitely going to be piano and strings. Got it. And then that became piano and string quartet. And at some point, no, all we really need is piano and cello.
Thank you.
there's a dialogue that's happening throughout the piece with them. You can hear it even in the beginning that the piano acts as a third-person narrator and sets the tale. It sets this little leitmotif. Remember we talked about how the entire piece is based on threes. So the very first thing we hear, we hear that in the piano. It's three notes. And it's also up a minor third and down a minor third. And for me, that's Julie's theme. And so it tells this little story. It also then iterates that theme three different times. And then on the downbeat of measure seven, that's when the cello first enters and enters on this middle C. And for me then, middle C, which permeates the entire piece, represents the veil that Tony talked about in the piece. That there's these two worlds, the world below middle C, that other side of the veil, and the world above middle C, the world of the living here. And so those two instruments, even from the very beginning, are setting up this dialogue and their function, I should say, in the rest of the piece as we start to tell the story. I think maybe we should talk a little more in detail, if you're up for it, about You Rise, I Fall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, You Rise, I Fall was certainly the hardest one for me to write, to go back to that awful day. This is the moment of Julie's death. She was in the hospital, and she was really fighting. She wanted to be a mother so much and to leave her little kids. And I don't know if she knew that this was going to be the day. She must have known in her heart because she was so afraid. And you know, the angels had to drag her into heaven. The day of her death was very, very painful. It was not a peaceful passing, I should say. And the hardest part for me of the entire Sacred Veil is the third stanza of You Rise, I Fall, as I remember reaching to Julie's face and closing her eyes. And the idea of You Rise, I Fall, at that point, her spirit is rising. Her spirit is seeing the veil. She's seeing her loved ones there calling to her. And as her spirit rises, of course, mine fell. And that was the beginning of a journey for me, a journey of grief and raising our children by myself and trying to make sense of this world without her. I get some comfort, though, from thinking that from Julie's perspective on the other side of eternity, we're here on this side, stuck in space and time, and Julie's gone. She is not with me. But from her perspective, on the other side of the sacred veil, there is no time. There is no space. Those things have no meaning. And so from Julie's perspective, we are already together, and we've always been together with our children forever. And I find that to be a very, very comforting thought.
Musically, I knew that the first time we hear You Rise, it needed to feel silky. And healing, in a way. When we get to that moment each time when they sing You Rise, it feels like a warm bath. That you're really being healed. And then the third time you say it is when it starts to turn. The idea of you rise and it goes up and everything twists. And then I fall. And it takes these consonant chords and then slowly, slowly bends them as they fall down. which musically was the best approximation I could give to what I had seen Tony go through.
It's one of the most dramatic things. It's one of the most dramatic things that I've ever heard a choir do. Those sliding chords and the fluidity of it, the anguish of the music matches the anguish I felt in that moment. It is very difficult for me to listen to that movement.
I was thinking the notes that I made about it was how the choir soars, kind of helping the soul on its way, and it almost sounded to me like a massive choral sunrise.
Ooh, that's beautiful.
I'm glad to hear you describe it that way, the first and second time that you hear "You Rise" in each of those three stanzas. Is that, yeah, warm bath. That's a really wonderful way of describing it.
In "You Rise, I Fall," as I say, it's entirely in C minor, and then the very last chord is holding there, and then it gently, slowly, slowly melts into what is essentially a C major chord, like a Picardy third, so that it's some maybe has resolved, but against that major third, way down in the mud, is also the fourth, and so the chord doesn't truly resolve. It vibrates in a way, and for me, this was having watched Tony go through all of this. It was seen that as best I can see, that grief isn't something that you ever are cured of or that ever goes away. It's just a wound that you learn to live with.
Yeah, the scar is like a talisman that I carry with me. It's a remembrance of what I went through and that was real and that our love was real and that the loss was real. And I'm a stronger person because of that experience. I certainly would wish to not have had that experience, but having had it, I can recognize the strength that it gives me. But you're right, it is unresolved. It's always there. It's become a part of me.
You also return to that concept of home throughout the piece. Every time the home idea comes back, it's like, oh, that just, it feels very comforting despite all that's going on.
Yeah, and that was interesting how that emerged as the central theme of the piece. And it really comes down to that moment that Tony talked about when he thought you feel like home. And that even you painted this idea of the wanderer. So just searching, 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 you find someone that feels like home, then in a way that whole home is exploded. And then finally Child of Wonder, the last things that the choir sings, then acting as Greek chorus, says, "Welcome home, my child, welcome home." So not only for Julie, who's now gone to the other side of the veil and has found this new home that you talk about in the first movement, but yeah, whence or whither a new home waits, but that also Tony gets a chance to come home.
And that's really how I experience it every time I hear it. I let it wash over me as a gift to me, and as a message, a good word that I need to hear. You know, everybody in the audience brings something to a choir concert that they need to hear. And for me, it's this part.
Eric Whitaker and Tony Silvestri talking about their latest project, The Sacred Veil, with the Los Angeles Master Chorale and Artistic Director Grant Gershon. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing that you can do for this show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. That's new classical tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julia Macher.